Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, along with our co-host, Bullet Lewis. We begin our program with a couple of selections from the Daily Word, published by Unity. Cherish. I grow in love when I cherish the people and all life on earth. I cherish the myriad expressions of life on this earth, including my own. I open my heart and nurture my fellow divine beings and all creatures with loving kindness. As I look upon creation with soft eyes, I love generously, without expectation of reciprocation or other response. I love as God, Spirit, the universe loves, unconditionally and without judgment. Cherishing others also means I release any agendas about how they should live. I bless them and pray they have the freedom and bravery to live according to the call of their soul. My heart overflows with love for all of creation. When I find the presence of God, of Spirit, of the universe everywhere, I become eager to share my love. I grow in appreciation by cherishing the world around me. Belonging. I belong to the family of God, of Spirit, of the universe. When I behold my fellow divine beings, I may see folks from different walks of life with a variety of histories, stories, and perspectives, traveling paths that are unique to them. Although we may be different on the surface, we are all members of the same spiritual family. When I focus on the divine inheritance we share as children of God, of Spirit, of the universe, I see kindred spirits, fellow spiritual travelers on the path of growth and understanding. Having this perspective about others' belonging helps me better feel my own. Should I feel like an outsider or someone who doesn't belong, I remember that I am foremost a spiritual being, and I am part of everything the universe, Spirit, God is. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want, Being Present to the Life You Have, Questions Put to the Sick, 4. When was the last time you listened to the stories of others? Question put to the sick by a Native American medicine man. I found myself in a psychodrama group that met every other week for 2 years. I didn't have any idea what psychodrama was and would never have tried it, except that the man who led the group was a sage to me. I knew he had more to teach me, and I had vowed to myself to participate in whatever he was doing. It turned out that psychodrama was a process by which we each took turns bringing to life a part of our inner story in the hope that by acting out dreams or current conflicts or unresolved pieces of our past, we might, with each other's help, unfold some wisdom that would help us live our lives. I didn't want to go first, and it was several weeks before I found the courage to take my turn. At first, I thought I'd just wait on the perimeter and watch how this would all unfold. But unexpectedly and with great gravity, I began to see that each person's story, no matter how different from my own, would suddenly be about a part of me that I'd never given voice to. I discovered that taking part in another's dream or conflict or unresolved past was just a deeper way of listening, a deeper way of being present. The reward for such deep listening was the incredible honor of first witnessing a living model of human courage, and then finding comfort and healing in the surprise that our stories are really all the same. It seems the ancient medicine men understood that listening to another's story somehow gives us the strength of example to carry on, as well as showing us aspects of ourselves we can't easily see. For listening to the stories of others, not to their precautions or personal commandments, is a kind of water that breaks the fever of our isolation. If we listen closely enough, we are soothed into remembering our common name. Breathe slowly and meditate on being open and receptive today. As you move through your day, give over your energy to listening. As you hear the stories of others, be aware of when one touches a part of your own story. If you can, offer a thread of your own story as a gift in return. Inside gravity. Inside gravity, the same things happen, just slower. When a plate breaks, we call it an accident. When a heart breaks, we call it sad. If it is ours, we say tragic. When a dream breaks, we sometimes call it unfair. Yet ants drop dirt and manage more, and birds drop food and peck again. But as humans, when we drop what we need, philosophies and complaints abound. It's not that we moan, but that we stop living to hear ourselves moan. Still, stars collide and histories begin. In our world, something is always letting go, and something is always hitting the earth. Often that which lets go survives by releasing, by not holding on until what needs to go is ripped from it. Often that which is hit survives by staying soft, by allowing what hits it to temporarily shape it the way stones shape mud. As humans, we take turns letting go and being hit. Love softens this process, and peace slows it down, until in moments that are blessed, we seem to play catch with what we need. As you inhale, bring to mind what is currently hitting you and how you might soften to lessen its impact. As you exhale, bring to mind what is currently needing to move away from you and how you might open yourself to more easily release it. And I want to share now a segment of an article from Science of Mind, the December issue. It's still late in coming to us, but they send their apologies. And here is a bit of a segment about CSL's 2024 spiritual hero. I do not think we should make such a claim to divinity that we forget we are human, for our humanity proclaims the creativity of the divine. Ernest Holmes, Know Yourself. Dr. Jean Houston is the 2024 spiritual hero, and this is from their website. Traditionally, in December, we honor a spiritual hero for the past year. The only requirements are this person cannot be part of Centers for Spiritual Living and must be doing impactful work in the world, aligned with the Science of Mind philosophy. For 2024, our spiritual hero is Dr. Jean Houston, scholar, philosopher, and researcher in human capacities. Houston is regarded as one of the principal founders of the human potential movement, noted for her ability to combine history, culture, new science, spirituality, and human development. She has written 26 books and the foreword to the 1997 edition of The Science of Mind. At 87, Dr. Jean Houston teaches, inspires, and passes on a quantum torch to the next generation of new thought leaders. Her presence and wisdom are constant at Centers for Spiritual Living around the world. In the December issue of Science of Mind, Houston offers this wisdom for us all. We are part of the great oneness, she says. Stretch out your hand and say, yes, I am part of this oneness, and practice that oneness. In that way, you then do not fall into the league of forgetfulness. You are living at the end of the old history and the beginning of the new one. Celebrate that every day. She invites us to think of the universe in a motherly way to make a deeper connection. Know that you are nested, cared for, grown, and greatly loved. Then the quantum fields of knowledge, creativity, and action become alive in you to awaken you. She advises each of us to remember that you are the universe and can be the universe in the most intimate way. New levels of consciousness begin to emerge on physical, psychological, and spiritual levels. You begin to see reality for what it is, infinite. Your brain-mind system is restructured. In all things, her advice is, go back to oneness. And when we receive the issue, we'll read the full article based on an interview conducted by one of her students, Reverend Alicia Christopher, Senior Minister of CSL Santa Cruz in California. We turn now to the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and the column by Paul Sutherland, The Heart of Happiness. Stuck on your path? One of the great gifts of writing a column is receiving responses from readers that move me or even push me to think harder or feel more deeply, especially notes like the one that arrived after my May-June column on getting stuck was published. The reader wrote to me about becoming stuck in grief. People talk about losing a parent or a spouse, but not very often about the loss of a sibling, she wrote. My brother and I were both caregivers for our 90-year-old homebound mother. My brother recently fell down the stairs, broke his neck, and never regained consciousness. I have trouble accepting the reality of this and how God could let this happen since we really needed the help to care for our mom. Her story stuck with me. Imagine you're in partnership with your brother, dutifully caring for your fading mother. Then your brother, care partner, falls dead. There's your mom's grief from losing a child on top of your own grief and shock from losing a brother. On top of all that are the now double duties of caregiving and presumably additional financial pressures as well. How to answer such a letter? How not to recoil? In part, I think because it's the sort of scenario that can happen to any of us at any moment in time. For me, the note was a reminder that life is always a blink of an eye away from the kind of sudden and irrevocable change that could leave me wondering, how could God let this happen? I have lost many people over the years. The first was my best friend Jackie, killed at age 19 by a drunk driver who ran a stoplight. To this day, I can tear up easily thinking about how much our friendship and all we shared meant to me. Looking back over the decades, I can add up many additional losses as if the equation leads to a certain expertise. And I think it has for me. I've also sat in hospice meetings and read articles and books on dealing with grief and loss. All of that has helped me see the reality of death as unchangeable and permanent, a truth we can take refuge in because we know it's not personal. It's universal. We do not know when we will die. We do know, however, that the present moment is precious. What I'm most grateful for is that I have not developed emotional calluses from my experience with death. I still feel on occasion like the wind has been ripped out of my lungs, eliminating any joy or hope, and muting any comfort my years of mental mantras normally provide. I still at times sit in the deep sadness of grief. I still experience the intensity of or subtle sad feelings as they move through me. My life remains full, and those sad feelings always move through. But in the sadness, I can imagine a time when they don't. When my dad was dying of cancer, he would tell me candidly about his pain and his worries about leaving his six kids fatherless, with a widow to raise all of them. He would end by saying, "Paul, please do not tell your mother or others about our conversations. They will be having a hard time with all of this." I was 25 at the time, and I felt lucky that he trusted me, as well as gratitude that I could help my big, strong, always there father feel less guilt about his pending death. I also felt his love and compassion for others, and that made me strong. Late at night, after the nurses had reminded me many times that visiting hours had ended, I would leave the hospital and walk out into the deep, crisp night air and cry. When Dad died, my mom kept herself together by making sure her six kids were okay. "I loved your father," she told me, "but I have no time for grief. I have to go to work and hold things together for your siblings." Her constant doings were a great help to me. Around the same time, I also read Siddhartha, which changed my thinking. Siddhartha concluded that there is little difference between a monk using asceticism to escape the outer world self and an oxcart driver drinking rice wine. He thought it better to accept the reality of our lives by savoring each moment without judging it as good or bad, to move beyond pain to acceptance. People die. We get sick. Suffering happens. Musing on it now, it reminds me that life is always at the edge of a sudden and irrevocable plunge into what happens. In the scriptures of nearly every religion, it says we attain enlightenment, heaven, and basic well-being through the practice of compassion, not by receiving compassion, but by taking the suffering and pain of others and giving back love and compassion. Simple. Of course, practicing compassion also means being loving and compassionate toward ourselves as well. It calls us to own our power to transform a moment through listening or action, to make loving choices that express compassion. We can recognize that our actions are loving and honorable because we then feel a warm inner sense of joy, happiness, contentment, and ease. But we can also be practicing compassion and feel completely stuck, like when your brother falls and dies and leaves you to care for your mother alone. There are, of course, myriad practical things to do when you feel stuck. Write a columnist for help. Find a grief counselor. Check in with a financial advisor. Join a support group. Walk with friends. Practice yoga. Breathe. Plenty of lists exist that share these suggestions and more, and such doings often prove helpful. What may also help is the realization beyond good and bad that you're not stuck on your spiritual path. Stuck is a path of compassion. And I'll share a little ad that's in here for a book that sounds inspiring. Ignite Your Path to Abundance and Success The Perfect Gift for the Holidays, or A New Beginning, and it's by James Parker. Break free from limiting beliefs and step into a life of prosperity, purpose, and joy. The Wealth Spark offers practical lessons, empowering affirmations, and actionable strategies to help you manifest success in every area of your life, whether it's enhancing your financial well-being, elevating your career, healing your past, or deepening your spiritual connection. Perfect for personal growth, group study, or spiritual classes, the Wealth Spark is more than just a book. It's a transformational journey. And the principles and practices in this book will start you firmly on the path to stepping into your greater yet to be. Take it in and be abundantly blessed. And that's from Michael Bernard Beckwith, founder and CEO of Agape International Spiritual Center. And you can order a copy by going to, all one word, thewealthsparkbook.com. And I've been a little slow, as usual in later years, to acknowledge that Christmas is coming. And it must mean it's time for some Christmas songs. And let's start with some spirit-lifting song. Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare him room. And heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing. Joy to the world, the Savior reigns. Let men their songs employ, while fields and floods, rocks, hills, and plains repeat the sounding joy, repeat the sounding joy, repeat, repeat the sounding joy. He rules the world with truth and grace, and makes the nations prove the glories of his righteousness, and wonders of his love, and wonders of his love, and wonders, wonders of his love. We return now to Science of Mind for the monthly column by Kelly Isola, Classic and Contemporary View. Hope in Violence. Don't say that I will depart tomorrow. Even today I am still arriving. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that is alive. Thich Nhat Hanh. Please call me by my true names. I sometimes struggle finding hope. We live amid rampant worldwide violence, injustice, suffering, and destruction to the environment. Humans have become masterfully creative at dangerous speech, violent acts, apathy, and myriad other dehumanizing practices. I feel angry, afraid, ashamed, befuddled, and desolate. As I sit with all this swirling around inside, I realize I also feel powerless. Feeling powerless is debilitating. It robs us of knowing our innate worth, as well as how connected we are with all life. This is the price of any act of dehumanization. Then comes the most damaging piece. We are robbed of inner power, that power of knowing we are a part of something larger, that we matter. At first, being powerless is lonely and confusing. Soon, under the weight of self-disgust, its sibling, shame, emerges. For some, it takes root, builds a home, sometimes a whole village, and puts up billboards to remind us that we are indeed to be used and tossed aside. We begin to anticipate what will happen next, afraid of the future, dwelling in what was, what could have been or might have been. Unfortunately, none of this will help us know what it means to be alive, to once again know a sense of power in our world. The future is merely an idea, and the past can't be undone. The present, whatever is going on, is the only place we can live if we are to have hope of taking down the billboards left behind by some stranger in our village. The present moment is not a fixed time or place. It is never done. It is still arriving. It's diaphanous, delicate, and translucent because it is always just becoming, a moving point of light where all creation is simply hinting at being visible. It is in these moments I witness my life, no longer a spectator, which is what I am when I look to the past or anticipate the future. Still arriving is the vantage point where I find my salvation. I rediscover my inner power in knowing everything is done, imagined, spoken, believed, and thought by me. When I can see things as they are and accept the invitation to courageously witness the landscape of life, not as a spectator, but as a creator, then I am still arriving, still awakening, still knowing my innate goodness. This is the billboard I will see at the entrance to my village nowadays. I know once again that I am part of something larger, that I matter, that my body is a wonderland, and that to be is to be related to you, because none of this happens alone. Only then, as I am still arriving, do I reach out to let another know that they matter, that they belong. In reaching out without the shame, tempered always by latitude of thought, I make visible what is beautiful, good, and true. Love. In the end, hope, like true faith, is based on the connection of your soul and mine. Hope is not optimism. Hope has its source in the rhythm of my heart, the birth and death of all that is alive. Hope takes into account grace and the divine intent that unfolds as we still arrive. This is hope in the midst of violence. Kelly Isola is a teacher, unity minister, and consultant who is certified in various leading-edge models of both organizational and human development. She is the co-author of Who Have You Come Here to Be? Visit, all one word, Kelly Isola, KellyIsola.com. And now it's time for another fun song. Let's jingle some bells. Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtails ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. The song's title and opening phrase refer to the bells that were attached to horses' harnesses in New England winters to prevent collisions. The rhythm of the song is said to mimic the sound of a horse's bells trotting. The word bobtail in the song refers to an animal with a crop tail, likely a horse with bells on its harness. And the song is about the exhilarating spirit of sleigh rides during the holidays. The song's main line, dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, captures this feeling. We turn now to an older issue of Light of Consciousness and an article by Eckhart Tolle, Stillness, Let Go of Excessive Thinking and See How Everything Changes. I thought this might be something good to share during this holiday season. When you are present in this moment, you break the continuity of your story, of past and future. Then true intelligence arises, and also love. This teaching isn't based on knowledge, on new interesting facts, new information. The world is full of that already. You can push any button on the many devices you have and get information. You're drowning in information. And ultimately, what is the point of it all? More information, more things, more of this, more of that. Are we going to find the fullness of life through more things and greater and bigger shopping malls? Are we going to find ourselves through improving our ability to think and analyze and accumulate more information, more stuff? Is more going to save the world? It's all form. You can never make it on the level of form. You can never quite arrange and accumulate all the forms that you think you need so that you can be yourself fully. Sometimes you can do it for a brief time span. You can suddenly find everything working in your life. Your health is good. Your relationship is great. You have money, possessions, love, and respect from other people. But before long, something starts to crumble here or there, either the finances or the relationship, your health or your work or living situation. It is in the nature of the world of form that nothing stays fixed for very long, and so it starts to fall apart again. The voice in the head that never stops speaking becomes a civilization that is obsessed with form and therefore knows nothing of the most important dimension of human existence, the sacred, the stillness, the formless, the divine. What does it profit you if you gain the whole world and lose yourself? It has been said that there are two ways of being unhappy, not getting what you want and getting what you want. When people attain what the world tells us is desirable, wealth, recognition, property, achievement, they're still not happy, at least not for long. They're not at peace with themselves. They don't have a true sense of security, a sense of finally having arrived. Their achievements have not provided them with what they were really looking for, themselves. They have not given them the sense of being rooted in life, or as Jesus calls it, the fullness of life. The form of this moment is the portal into the formless dimension. It is the narrow gate that Jesus talks about that leads to life. Yes, it's very narrow. It's only this moment. To find it, you need to roll up the scroll of your life on which your story is written, past and future. Before there were books, there were scrolls, and you rolled them up when you were done with them. So, put your story away. It is not who you are. People usually live carrying a burden of past and future, a burden of their personal history, which they hope will fulfill itself in the future. It won't. So roll up that old scroll. Be done with it. You don't solve problems by thinking. You create problems by thinking. The solution always appears when you step out of thinking and become still and absolutely present, even if only for a moment. Then, a little later, when thought comes back, you suddenly have a creative insight that wasn't there before. Let go of excessive thinking and see how everything changes. Your relationships change because you don't demand that the other person should do something for you to enhance your sense of self. You don't compare yourself to others or try to be more than someone else to strengthen your sense of identity. You allow everyone to be as they are. You don't need to change them. You don't need them to behave differently so that you can be happy. There's nothing wrong with doing new things, pursuing activities, exploring countries, meeting new people, acquiring knowledge and expertise, developing your physical or mental abilities, and creating whatever you're called upon to create in this world. It is beautiful to create in this world, and there is always more that you can do. Now the question is, are you looking for yourself in what you do? Are you attempting to add more to who you think you are? Are you compulsively striving toward the next moment and the next, hoping to find some sense of completion and fulfillment? The preciousness of being is your true specialness. What the egoic self had been looking for on the level of the story, I want to be special, obscured the fact that you could not be more special than you already are now. Not special because you're better or more wretched than someone else, but because you can sense a beauty, a preciousness, an aliveness deep within. When you are present in this moment, you break the continuity of your story of past and future. Then true intelligence arises, and also love. The only way love can come into your life is not through form, but through that inner spaciousness that is presence. Love has no form. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications. And you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio on demand. We return now to Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution by Rainn Wilson. And we had started in Chapter 6, Religion, Smeligion, which he's talking about the fact that now I'm certain that celebrities have existed in every culture that has ever been throughout the entirety of human history. Artists, warriors, generals, gladiators, writers, sportsmen, politicians, as well as great and legendary beauties. We human beings love to obsess over the famous and infamous. Always have, always will. But were they revered and scrutinized in the past as they are in 2023 with the same rapturous, feverish intensity? We witness through social media every red carpet outfit, every gaffe, every vacation, every romance. Every TikTok or Instagram post by contemporary celebrities is combed over, discussed, and explored ad nauseum in every possible medium. They fill our screens, our billboards, our imaginations, our mythology, and the general populace eats those stories up as swiftly as the press continues to regurgitate them. Sports figures are our new cultural warrior heroes, our contemporary Hercules and Odysseus. Millions can recount the stats, accomplishments, and GOAT exploits of Tom Brady, Michael Jordan, Messi, and Serena Williams, musicians, models, and actors are our Zeus and Hera and Jupiter, their likenesses surrounding Times Square like so many towering Roman sculptures, legions of infamous entrepreneurial icons of Silicon Valley like WeWork's Adam Neumann, the Ronos Elizabeth Holmes, and Uber's Travis Kalanick are showered with billions of dollars in investment, invited to appear on magazine covers, and feted like rock stars before their narcissism ultimately becomes too much to bear, and they eventually crash back down to earth like some Silicon Icarus. Producer and author Gautam Chopra, Deepak's son, has an entertainment company called Religion of Sports that focuses on a main thesis of his work. In the modern world, sports is our religion. He posits that athletic competitions and massive arenas give the modern man everything a collective religious experience can give you: transcendence, holy moments, community, a common goal, a striving for human perfection, awe. In his view, stadiums are contemporary society's new cathedrals, filled with passionate congregants seeking rapture. But setting the worship of celebrity and sports aside, the fastest growing religion is one you may not have heard of. Its followers are called the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. So-called because on surveys, when asked about religious affiliation, they check none or none of the above. Nuns are agnostics and atheists, yes, but by far the majority are self-titled spiritual but not religious. This is a category ascribed to by well over a third of millennials and far more Gen Zers. 60% of nuns grew up in a religious family, usually Protestant. A third of nuns meditate, and again, most describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, and their ranks are growing at an outrageous rate. Since 2008, when scholars began tracking them, their membership has swelled by 60%, whereas church membership has declined from 70% in the mid-90s to about 45% in 2023. Why are so many young Americans and Europeans identifying as none of the above when it comes to religion? Certainly, there's a tremendous groundswell of an anti-church feeling where young folks simply don't connect to some old-fashioned practice of church-going. There are countless teachings that many 20-somethings vehemently disagree with in contemporary organized religion. Many of them have to do with sexuality, laws and moral teachings around homosexuality, abortion rights, premarital sexual relations, and traditional gender roles, laws that are frequently exhorted in more long-established church-sanctioned lifestyles, the way so many Protestants, the principal faith being abandoned in the U.S., have consistently aligned themselves with conservative politics is also off-putting to many who find themselves in the political center or left. Also, the strange antagonism that some branches of Protestantism have recently shown toward science, plus the emphasis on non-believers burning in hell, are frequently cited in surveys as top reasons that young people are leaving the faith of their parents. Many of the youth I've personally spoken to vehemently recoil from the judgmentalism and hypocrisy of so many religious institutions. I find it fascinating that for many coastal and urban nuns, meditation is an important part of their spiritual practice, yet so few of them formally pray. And conversely, so many young folks from Middle America who are still practicing Christians find prayer to be at the center of their spiritual practice, but infrequently meditate. In other words, half the country meditates and the other half prays, but very few participate in both. If prayer is defined as talking to God, beseeching, thanking, glorifying, connecting, and meditation is listening, being still and attuning to the divine vibration of the universe, there seems to be a disconnect. It would seem that the conversational back and forth between these two dynamics would ultimately provide the most bang for the spiritual buck, no? As this tendency, for the most part, seems to fall along conservative and liberal lines, it once again proves that we Americans are culturally divided in almost every respect. The other issue that seems to factor in while examining this mass exodus from organized religion is the increasing and continuing, note, American, emphasis put on the individual over the collective. From the outset, our nation has been founded on the idea of liberty, especially in the form of personal freedoms. Live free or die, and don't tread on me, are two of our founding state mottos, after all. Liberty and the pursuit of happiness are two of our favorite inalienable rights from the Declaration of Independence. Part of the mythology of the New World of America is a pull-yourself-up-by-your-own-bootstraps and self-made-man brand of rugged individualism that has increasingly led toward autonomy being synonymous with freedom. And this seems to be foundationally at odds with so much of the collective nature of our country's founding story, when various European church groups seeking the freedom, there's that word again, to worship, assemble, and commune together in their preferred manner, headed across the pond to the New England. Over time, it seems the community aspect of American culture has increasingly let the populace down. Churches grow less accepting, small towns and villages spread out into faceless suburbs and exurbs, government becomes ever more bloated, polarized, and distrusted, national news outlets are viewed with increasing skepticism, family-owned businesses are absorbed into faceless corporations ruled by hedge funds and multinationals that only serve the bottom line. The population has thereby been pulling away from what used to provide communal containment and ever further toward isolated and individualistic ways of interacting with the world. The collective aspects of our culture seem to have failed us, and we've lost sight of the greater good created by the institutions that previously had bound us together in the social fabric. And this makes total sense, by the way. We have abandoned these institutions, sometimes for very good reasons, but what we've left behind is perhaps the thing we need most of all, connection. One of the fallouts of this tendency toward individualism is a very different understanding of the nature and purpose of religion itself. As our faith institutions have collectively let us down, more and more people view religion to be about a personal internal experience rather than any kind of cooperative shared endeavor. William James, in his epic and influential Varieties of Religious Experience, pointed out this modern spiritual trend more than 100 years ago. Religion shall mean for us the feelings, acts, and experiences of individual men in their solitude, so far as they apprehend themselves to stand in relation to whatever they may consider divine. And we must remember that many good things have transpired as organized religion has been increasingly shelved and the inner spiritual journey has been highlighted. Instead of blindly following dogmas, traditions, and empty rituals and ceremonies, many have sought truth, meaning, and beauty through a personal connection with the divine, an organic, mystical communication that had dried out in previous decades and centuries. There's also a terrific case to be made for the idea of let there be peace in the world and let it begin with me. It is true that peace needs to originate in the heart before it can spread to the family and then the neighborhood, town, county, state, country, and eventually the world. And if billions of people engaged in these personal spiritual practices, we would certainly feel a tide of healing change encircling the planet. This is all part of a long-term cultural evolution that leads young folks toward defining themselves for the most part as spiritual but not religious. And yet, for all its many inspirational benefits, this path also has its pitfalls. In my time in Los Angeles over the last 20-some years, as I've met more and more friends in what I would call the woo-woo yoga community, it increasingly feels like the purpose of modern spirituality is simply to make me feel better internally. It's a form of self-care, self-help, soothing, and solace. But toward what end? Does one's spiritual endeavor simply pause when one feels a brief respite from the persistent attacks of anxiety, imbalance, and disconnect? This way of thinking can easily lead to a kind of smorgasbord spirituality, where one picks and chooses what is best for oneself from a buffet of self-help healing options, i.e., I like this particular yoga class and this crystal to focus on. I like this meditation app and this specific New Age author. I like this particular inspiring podcast and that particular self-help book. In other words, picking and choosing what works for me in the same way that one shops for snacks at a Trader Joe's. There's absolutely nothing wrong with tending to one's spiritual garden and seeking peace, serenity, and connection. A personal, mystical, and spiritual experience is crucial, as is self-care. As the great Baha'i leader and teacher Shoghi Effendi says, for the core of religious faith is that mystic feeling that unites man with God. Personally, I pray and meditate every day in order to achieve some minimal kind of internal balance and harmony. I undertake this discipline not only to make me extra wise or enlightened, but simply to achieve a daily basic functionality. In other words, my spiritual practice simply gets me to a place where I can be relatively decent and not some kind of confused, tightly wound jerk, which is where my ego, monkey mind, and family trauma-induced internal barometer leads me. But I don't believe the work can end there. In fact, it must not. If the modern, more secular-minded, spiritual but not religious person seeks only to focus on the internal aspects of the experience, This potentially moves the practitioner toward a narcissistic New Age mindset. If one's practice is simply to quell anxiety with the use of tools like meditation, inspirational quotes on Instagram, and some excerpted Buddhist light teachings around being in the moment, this ultimately forms a categorical error. Anything you do purely for yourself can drift toward being self-centered and navel-gazing, which fits into our cultural penchant for narcissism and self-interest. When I was conversing on the Metaphysical Milkshake podcast with Brother Pop Hu of the world-renowned Plum Village Monastery, an intimate disciple of one of the century's greatest spiritual teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh, he spoke to this false modern version of spirituality. He said something to the effect of this: if we look at our spiritual practice in the same way we look at everything else we're doing in our daily lives, i.e., what's in it for me, then we're neglecting our human family and not addressing the suffering and sadness of those around us. This is not holy, sacred, or divine. It's ultimately wrapped in the same selfishness that pervades contemporary culture. When we think only about reducing our own internal anxiety, sadness, and dissatisfaction, and not about the suffering of people in Sudan or in our hometown or even in our household and family, what we miss out on is compassion for the suffering of others. This line of reasoning is taking us back to the Kung Fu Star Trek themes of Chapter 1. Over the past several decades, we have, as a culture, tended to focus on the personal transformation and not the necessary societal transformation element of the holy quest, the sacred path. This leads to, my life is better, but we are left with the question, is the world any better? An example of this kind of self-centered spiritual work is the recently rediscovered popularity of ayahuasca, ibogaine, and other hallucinogens. These plant medicine experiences have been growing in popularity over the last decade. Warning, unpopular opinion alert. This is not a new idea, kiddies. I'm old enough to remember countless folks talking about the mind, heart, soul opening effects of LSD in the 70s. Turn in, turn on, drop out. And how did that work out? Then in the 80s, there was peyote and the indigenous ceremonies that surrounded its usage. Then there were magic mushrooms. I went to college with many people who were essentially microdosing and regularly using MDMA, aka ecstasy or Molly, to achieve inspiration. These practices weren't invented recently by Silicon Valley creatives, Joe Rogan, or spiritual adventurers traveling in the Amazon and posting about it on Instagram, Gen Zers. Over the last 60 years, countless folks have talked about hallucinogens as a shortcut to God, bliss, and spiritual enlightenment. This is not to minimize the religious practice of hallucinogens by indigenous peoples. True, plant medicine. Why is it, by the way, that ayahuasca and peyote are plant medicines and the coca plant and heroin poppies aren't? Has been accessed as one of the many ceremonial tools toward enlightenment for thousands of years in profound religious practices by indigenous peoples of the Americas. However, they've been used as one small part of a ritual in conjunction with a myriad of other disciplines as part of a profound and ancient tapestry of cultural spiritual customs. That's not what is happening with today's modern ayahuasca tourism. And while there is substantial evidence that hallucinogens and other drugs such as MDMA and ketamine can be effectively used with professional medical guidance to treat extreme depression and addiction issues, to take them occasionally in an attempt to find any kind of lasting, profound, or overarching spiritual truth seems superficial and, frankly, a bit lazy. People who follow this path, for the most part, seem to be looking for a shortcut. I'm going to the jungles of Costa Rica or my friend's apartment in Berkeley or an Airbnb in La Jolla to do ayahuasca with a certified shaman and have a 9-hour experience of cosmic unity, which I can talk about on Twitter, podcasts, or at parties, and then my work is done. This is capitalistic, consumerist spirituality. I can simply pay for a pre-planned 48-hour experience of enlightenment and then go back to carrying on with my imbalanced work life, materialistic career goals, and chaotic personal life. It's like signing up for the instant vacation of a cruise to the Bahamas, only in this case it's booking a spiritual fulfillment vacation without any lasting devotion, practice, mission, commitment, or discipline. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. At the end of the day, in a healthy religious practice, there is a judicious balance between the two roads of Kung Fu and Star Trek. between self-experience and community service, between the inner quest and the outer mission, self-care and self-sacrifice for the greater good. I recently had a conversation with a brilliant writer friend of mine, and the topic drifted to religion and faith. As we spoke, I discussed various aspects of religion as a whole and why I had chosen to be a devout, albeit flawed, member of a specific religious faith. It quickly became clear that religion as a source of social good was not something he'd ever really considered. He thought of spirituality only as a means toward internal balance and not as any kind of force for community transformation and global harmony. It blew his mind as I related a few simple ideas to this effect. He was thunderstruck as I relate to him that the core of the word religion originated from the Latin verb ligare and was devised as follows, religio or religati, to fasten or bind together. That religion, while certainly a cause of disunity, violence, and judgmentalism, had at other times in human history been a force for progress, unity, and yes, even enlightenment. Religion? Really? A positive movement for progress and enlightenment? Impossible, you might say. And that's certainly what our epic trip to Israel made me feel at times. When our tour was finished, I looked around one last time at the Temple Mount, and my heart was saddened. As I gazed over the gorgeous ancient city of Jerusalem, I could feel the disunity and mistrust between faiths, a powder keg of simmering antagonism that could lead to world war, right here at the crux of three of the holiest sites in the world. There, in the most revered place on the planet, as we gave our hugs and goodbyes to Bruce, I was struck by the fact that sometimes peace and unity feels downright impossible, especially here in the Middle East. But as I considered my trip over the following months, I came to believe that maybe there's another way. Perhaps the path to seeing the world's religions as a potential source of progress is to explore the universal truths that unite them. Common threads that could show everyone everywhere that these faiths are not, at their core, as disparate and divisive as they appear. Perhaps they are all just different paths to one cosmic truth. Ooh, that's a good idea. Let's dig into that next. Chapter 7, The Fabulous Foundations of Faith. One of the most inspiring movements in human history happened during a mysterious period in our distant past, and I'm not talking about mid-90s grunge. This particular era has fascinated me ever since college when I took a class on the history of Christianity. It's the period between the death of Jesus and the conversion of Constantine. In other words, the first 300 years of the Christian spiritual movement on the planet Earth. We'll call it Church 101, before all that violence, complicated, and political Christendom took over. Yes, we know about the life of Paul of Tarsus, and we know a little bit about the geographic spread of this new faith tradition, thanks to the apostles. There were Gnostic gospels, rogue priests, and some weird ascetic sects of the nascent religion sprinkled about various scenic deserts. We've read stories about Christians being fed to the lions, but what was the early church really like on the ground? I'm not a Christian scholar or even a Christian, but from the little I know, I've been struck by the truly Catholic, as in its original definition of all-embracing, nature of the early church. After Paul spread the gospel to the Gentiles, non-Jews, and Christianity slowly moved away from being a revisionist, slightly updated version of Judaism, by and for Jews only, it rapidly spread over several decades throughout the Roman Mediterranean world. The idea central to the spread of the gospel in this post-apostolic phase of Christianity was that there was one God, the Father, and that one could achieve eternal life or salvation by acknowledging that he had sent his Son, the Christ or Savior, to bring the good news about the building of the kingdom of God on earth. He had died for our sins, gone up to heaven, and would return again. And most importantly, that one could show their devotion to said Christ the Savior by emulating his generous acts of service among the poor and outcast. Around this time, simple cults or small religious orders began popping up all over the place. Every city and people had their local gods, rituals, and ceremonies. People were talking about messiahs right and left, and the Roman gods were also honored, because if they weren't, you'd get stabbed in the face by a centurion. The God of the Jews, Elohim, Adonai, or Yahweh, depending, was not considered conceptually in this Roman world as the one true God, but rather as the God of the Jewish people in particular. One of countless gods to be worshipped, depending on geography and your tribal affiliation, kind of like following teams in the NFL. So when Paul called all other gods false idols and Yahweh or Jehovah the only true God, this was incredibly inflammatory, to say the least. The apostles taught that all were welcome to worship this one God if they simply accepted his Son as a Messiah in order to find meaning, purpose, and salvation in a blissful afterlife. This idea was quite intriguing. When the stories, teachings, and sayings of Jesus began to spread, and churches were formed all around the Mediterranean, a strange, beautiful, and utterly new thing transpired. A world that was tribal in every way, shape, and form found itself met with a religion that accepted all to its membership. One simply had to be baptized in Christ. They even had church open houses during sections of the Sunday worship services, which were open to those simply investigating this new global spiritual movement. So there we are, at a seminal moment in human history. For perhaps the very first time, a religious service, usually held outdoors, included a vast, diverse, and eclectic group of devotees. Picture handmade pews filled with Jewish workers, Phoenician sailors, shunned prostitutes, African merchants, Roman citizens, Egyptian monks, former slaves, and wealthy noblemen, all worshiping the same God. In some ways, one might say that Christianity is the first actual religion, in the modern sense, in that it offered a set of beliefs that folks of all backgrounds could ascribe to, as opposed to an inherited set of rituals mixed with a geographic identity and tribal inheritance. It was the first belief system one could join, regardless of your cultural affiliation, based on the precepts laid out in the early Gospels and by the nascent clergy. So for probably the first time in the history of humanity, a religious movement was greater than the tribe from which it originated. And in Christ's eyes, all were equal in the church and worthy of his love. Rich, poor, Roman, Jewish, African, no matter your history, class, or ethnicity, all people were brothers in Jesus' love. And sisters, too. Women played a significant role in the early centuries of Christianity, especially upper-class Roman women, including Emperor Constantine's mom. It was one of the few groups, maybe the only one, of that time that had a place where women could experience equality under God. A big tent, indeed. And as if that weren't enough, charity, alms, service. Early Christians were known for sacrificing their own comfort, time, and money to help the less fortunate of other tribes, races, classes, and peoples. What the F? Why on earth would members of this crazy, formerly Jewish cult spend their time, energy, and resources helping others outside of their own family, village, or tribe? They would even bring food, aid, and succor to poor folks who worshipped idols. All this in honor and emulation of this miraculous day laborer Jesus guy who hailed from some podunk dump called Nazareth over in Galilee. The early church was astoundingly revolutionary. This was a new civilization-wide idea. All are welcome, and altruism to all. The ripples of this idea are felt to this day, all stemming from the Mediterranean world on or about the year 100. Altruism, belonging, unity and diversity, service to something greater than our mere tribal identities, all springing from, you guessed it, a religion. Christians often get a bad rap in the press and online, but any time you're involved in a cause that involves a large, diverse group of people, think of the Christians. Anytime you're at a gathering where there's an urge towards something greater, something transcendent, think of early Christianity. Anytime you're working side by side with others in service to the less fortunate, remember the founders of the church in these early centuries. There are examples of this kind of cultural evolution from other religious movements as well. Early Buddhism had great similarities to the Christian movement. Throughout the Hindu world, acolytes were spreading the teachings of the Buddha on the root causes of and solutions for suffering, among many other spiritual tools for profound personal enrichment. They focused on a set of transcendent doctrines that were for everyone, not just for worshippers of a certain Hindu god or of a specific race, class, tribe, or geographic area. It was a faith practice that de-emphasized gods and rituals and re-emphasized the path to personal spiritual enlightenment. Enlightenment for all, including women who were allowed to become acolytes by Siddhartha Gautama and his early followers. And most importantly, this was a philosophical movement that was open to every caste. Rich or poor, touchable or untouchable, all were welcome to receive the profound teachings of the Buddha and participate in gatherings and devotions. In Islam, a bunch of disparate, warring, polytheistic tribes on the Arabian Peninsula, united under the banner of Muhammad and the Quran, had within a century created an awe-inspiring civilization that spread from Morocco to India. This worldwide flourishing Muslim culture with profound spiritual roots created algebra and soap and coffee and chemistry and rugs and surgical instruments and countless other inventions used today. They instigated a flourishing of arts that eventually trickled over and inspired the Renaissance in Europe and scientific advancements that the world had never before witnessed and are still used to this day. Hello, algorithms. In the golden age of Islam, all were welcome, regardless of tribe or background, united by this simple phrase, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And this was an empire founded on tolerance of members of other religions. The Quran states, do not abuse those whom they worship besides Allah. And the Imam Ali was quoted as saying, know that people are of two types. They are either your brothers in religion or your equals in creation. From the Nahru Balagha, Sermon 53. Not only that, but one of the five pillars of Islam is charitable giving, called zakat, putting it in a similar category as Christianity, with baked-in altruism in its genes. It can be challenging and somewhat misleading to categorize the various religious and spiritual movements that have appeared every 500 to 1,000 years or so under one vast umbrella of worldwide religious movements. At first glance, it feels like Buddhism is nothing at all like Islam, and Judaism couldn't be more divergent from Hinduism. Many faiths are monotheistic, some are polytheistic, and some are divinely agnostic. The karmic religions of the East, for the most part, feel completely and utterly different from the Abrahamic faiths in most every way. Some believe in a form of reincarnation. Others have a central authority, like a pope. Some are as decentralized as one can possibly imagine. Christianity has 45,000 various denominations around the globe. Islam has, essentially, two main sects. Two that, like Catholics and Protestants of centuries past, often have zero qualms killing each other in their prophet's name. And again, an interesting place for us to stop, but we will continue in the coming weeks with this very interesting rhetoric from Rainn Wilson. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.